Good morning, good afternoon, everybody. Welcome to Radio Laurier News at Noon. My name is Jeffrey. I'm here with my co-host Rajni, and today we're going to be covering some interesting news pieces.
Hey guys, so first of all, we're going to start off with covering some new updates to the Laurier Co-op program. So I'm not sure how many of you are actually involved in co-op, but they recently implemented some new minimums of applications. And I personally think that this is a bit counterproductive because it really just emphasizes the quantity approach over the quality approach. So what they've recently implemented is that in the first round, which is primary round where you do the rank match process, you have to apply to a minimum of 20 jobs. And then for the whole process, you have to apply to a minimum of 50 jobs.
Oh my God.
The problem with that is that, okay, at least last year when I did my first work term, there was a lot of emphasis on the quantity over the quality method. But for me personally, I think that didn't really work as well because my strategy for applying was just applying to stuff I was interested in. And so because I was interested in it, I could put all the effort into making a really good cover letter, like a really good resume. And I ended up, I applied for like maybe 20 jobs and I got like 5 interviews because of that approach. And so I think that that proves that it works for me, and I'm sure it would work for other people. So I know that like lots of people were applying to like 50, 60, 70 jobs, but at least it wasn't mandated, you know? But then this year, because of COVID and everything, they said that in order to increase your chances of getting a position due to it being more competitive during the COVID period, that they implemented these minimums. And I just think that that doesn't really make any sense.
Yeah, that is 50, 70 jobs. That is insane.
That's a lot.
Like, especially
what if you don't find 20 that you like, you know?
Yeah, that's what I'm saying. Like, for example, like, I'm in communication studies.
Mm-hmm,
I'm not going to do co-op, but, like, if I was going to, like, how am I going to find 70 communication, 70. Like, job op? You know what I'm saying? Like,
yeah,
that can seem a bit excessive. I'm not going
to
lie.
And I think what they're emphasizing is like just apply to stuff because even if it's not really within your skill set or your interest level, just apply to it just because you want to cast a wide net and keep your options open and everything. And I mean, that's good, yes, but I think it's a waste of time when you emphasize applying to a whole lot of jobs poorly instead of just focusing on a small handful and doing them really well.
Yeah, and correct me if I'm wrong, but is the process to applying to these places like time consuming? Like, I feel like it probably is.
I think it depends on what approach you take. So for me, it is kind of time consuming because I make a separate cover letter for each application, and the cover letter will emphasize different skill sets and different things. And I know some people do like a different resume for each one where they emphasize their different jobs or their different positions and extracurriculars depending on what the role requests from you. So yeah. I would say that doing a really good application package could take you up at least half an hour. If you have like a template kind of for your cover letter, and if you're using the same resume, you can still take about half an hour to write, to put together each package and to just make sure everything's perfect, you know?
Crazy. So
right?
50 jobs is going to take you 25 hours.
Exactly. Like,
best case scenario. That's
exactly
insane.
I know, right? And then the thing is, most of us are taking full-time course loads, so that's 4 or 5 courses. And then I'm sure people have jobs outside of school too, plus the extracurriculars, plus, you know, basic human needs like eating and sleeping. So
yeah,
I just think it's a little unreasonable, especially because we're not even in the best position for mental health and like stress management right now.
Oh yeah,
it's just gonna make everything a lot worse. So
no,
that
just seems so stressful for like no real reason. Like I get where they're coming from, just because it's harder to sort of find opportunities, but still, that's just a lot.
I think it's unreasonable for it to be a mandate. I think they should give the advice to apply to lots of jobs and to expand your nets and be open-minded and everything. That's all great, but I think to make it mandatory just ignores the fact that it excludes people who don't work in that way. And it puts them at a disadvantage because then they're going to be stressed out for no reason trying to meet quotas instead of actually focusing on the quality of their work.
No, I completely agree. I think there's a lot of sort of focus on our current education system on like a sort of binary way of how to go about doing school. Like,
yeah,
oh, if you work this amount and if you read this amount, you know what I'm saying? But like for me, for example, like honestly, I don't do all the readings that I get assigned just because I can't physically sit there and read for that amount. I have like attention sort of problems, but I'm still able to kind of adapt and figure out ways to do it.
Yeah.
But then there's people who wouldn't be able to adapt, and then they're just kind of stuck having to learn a specific way, and they you know, they have no idea that there's probably other ways to go about this.
Exactly. And really, I think it just reflects on how our education system is. Sorry for interrupting. I think it's annoying how our education system kind of focuses on only one way of doing things, and it doesn't really allow for lots of adjustment by people who don't fit into that mold. Because it's like, if you don't learn by the traditional methods of sitting down and studying and listening to lectures, then people, like the school system, and you eventually might start to consider yourself as like dumb or not smart, you know?
Yeah. Like, oh, I just had a thought, but I lost it. I'll come back to it. But
no problem.
Let's talk about the sperm headline.
Yeah, okay. So apparently in the US, due to COVID, the sperm bank industry, yes, it is an industry, has experienced severe problems and shortages, because apparently being in isolation has created people's need or desire to have a child. So people in the sperm banks have experienced a drop in donors, and the recipients of sperm have had difficulty finding the ideal donor. So there's a whole science that goes into this thing where people, they say like, oh, I want the smart sperm or like the athletic sperm. So they go through a whole vetting process on Facebook groups.
Wow.
To find people who either fit their looks criteria or their intellectual criteria or their skill criteria. You can literally design your own child by using that sperm.
I guess it kind of makes sense, but that's still just so weird to think about.
I know, right? But apparently 30,000 to 60,000 children are born via sperm donors, and it's an industry that amounts to over $4 billion according to 2018 numbers.
That's crazy. That is really crazy. And it makes sense, because like, for example, my parents, because of the pandemic, felt inclined to get a dog, like a puppy.
Yeah, right.
And it turns out that like more than half of their friends also wanted to get puppies, or like there's a huge boom in people, like, because everyone's locked inside, you know, you want something to sort of,
and you want some companionship, you know.
Yeah, exactly. Oh, that is very interesting. That makes a lot of sense to me.
So for more statistics, most people assume that gay couples would be the majority users of sperm banks. Which is true. So 60% of sperm bank customers are gay women. And then actually 20% are heterosexual couples who, for whatever reason, can't conceive of their own. And 20% are actually single moms by choice.
Oh, really?
Yeah.
That is very interesting.
That is interesting. And I think it really reflects how far, I guess, we've come in terms of social norms for women, you know? Because before, you'd never, like, being a single mother was a bad thing, or like you'd never want to be a single mother. But now it's like people choose to actively do that, and they spend inordinate amounts of money at sperm banks to get all the treatments done and the sperm and the IVF.
I mean, shout out to all the single moms by choice, because that must be really difficult.
It's a hard job, and you like took it on actively.
Yeah, like, I guess like the people who do that are probably the type of people that are just really in control and just know what they're doing, you know? Like, I don't think a lot of people who weren't ready for it would even attempt to do it.
So
shout out to them. Shout out to all the single moms.
Yeah.
Okay, so we're going to switch to a bit of international news. And I'm going to actually start off with some African news that I found very interesting. So currently, there was an election in Uganda. And for all the viewers who don't know, Uganda is sort of a country in sub-Saharan Africa. I guess it's on the Middle East sort of part of Africa. So They've had a dictator. I think his name's pronounced Museveni or something like that. And he's been in power for, I think it's over 30 years. Like, he's essentially a dictator.
Yeah.
And this past election was one of their first elections where he had, like, a viable opposition opponent. And the opposition, his name is Bobby Wine. Mm-hmm. And he's actually a famous Ugandan pop star. So, like, he's famous from...
That's his opposition?
Yeah, he's a musician. He's famous from his music.
Oh my God.
Sort of decided to take on the role of trying to become the president. And so, here's a crazy statistic. 80% of Uganda's population, 80% is under the age of 35.
Wow, that's a very young population.
80%, yeah. So he definitely has the numbers of youth who probably know him through his music and just because he's an icon in the country.
Definitely.
He had the numbers. And then the election results just came out, and it turns out that he lost. But he's claiming voter fraud, much like Trump, except this time he actually has, like, a viable information as to why, like, fraudulent.
Wow.
For example, like, on the day of his on the day of the election, government forces, like, surrounded his house and, like, broke in and beat up the security guards, and then they're just kind of like,
that's crazy.
Just, like, keeping him there. Yeah, it's crazy to me. But Bobby Wine, shout out to my man. Hopefully he's okay. He survived several assassination attempts. Like, not surprisingly, dictator, opposition, kind of similar to what's going on in Russia with Alexei Navalny. Did you hear about that story?
Oh, yeah, I heard he got arrested, like, as soon as he returned to Russia.
So for our viewers who don't know, he's the Russian opposition leader, and he got poisoned, I think, back in October or September.
That was
almost 100% it was the Kremlin who did it, like the Russian government, essentially.
Sorry, wait, just to clarify, was he the same one who got, he was living in the UK and he got poisoned, or is that a different person?
I think that's a different person. I know who you're talking about. Yeah, the Russian government has a thing with poisoning people, apparently.
Yeah, clearly.
But no, I think that Navalny was, I think he was in some European country when he was poisoned, or maybe he left Russia. I think he left and then he just came back and he got arrested at the airport, which is just insane, but shout out to Russia.
So why did he come back? That's my question.
I'm not too sure. I didn't really look too much into the story just because it's just so crazy. There's just so much going on these days, Rajni. It's so hard to keep up with everything.
Because he would have known that was going to happen. So why would he return if he had the choice, you know?
Yeah, I think it's a lot like Bobby Wine. Like, the fact that Bobby Wine, whose real name is Robert Kyagulanyi, I can't pronounce it, but his real name's Robert. So Bobby Wine, like, why would you want to be the opposition leader to, like, a 30-year dictator? You know what I'm saying?
Yeah.
Almost a death sentence, especially in a country like Uganda. But, like, obviously, he's fed up enough, and he knows he has enough support that he feels like,
he has a chance.
Yeah, like, he probably is at the point where he's like, even if I die, the movement will still go in, which I think is really respectable.
Yeah, it's the same. I guess it's the same kind of logic that made Trump want to run against Clinton, because I mean, she was a career politician. Like, by on paper alone, she was more qualified than he was, but yet he still won. So,
yeah, it's funny. It's almost it's similar to Trump, and it's almost like a reverse version of it. Because Trump was sort of like the bad politician, like the non-politician.
Yeah, the outsider.
I mean, and honestly, no one really knows if Bobby Wine does take power, like, how much reforms he's going to implement. That's obviously still for debate, but I think just the fact that he's a pop star sort of shows that he's more for the people than he really is. He's just trying to get the dictator out of power more than anything, I think. But, you know, you never know with these power struggles. You know, it always seems like, oh, we're going to help the country. We're going to get rid of the dictator. We're going to change it. And then it's just another dictatorship. You know what I'm saying? Like, that's a lot of that happens across the world. So,
yeah, definitely.
So there's that. And I also want to touch on a topic which I think we've definitely discussed in the past, but I just think it's so underreported at this point that it just needs to be reiterated. So let's talk about the Uyghur situation in China, which is essentially a cultural genocide. And what made me want to bring it up is I actually saw, I think it was a video or maybe an article of a Uyghur woman who just got out of the detentions, like the detention camps, and she's sort of giving her story of what happened.
Yeah.
And it's crazy. So essentially she left Xinjiang, like I think in 2099 to go to France to just live, because even back then the treatment for the Uyghur people was still not good. So she went to France, she's living for 10 years, and then she gets a phone call from some Chinese bureaucracy, like some Chinese bureaucrat, and essentially the guy says, hi, you need to renew some like paper, like your birth certificate or something like that, come back, sign these papers, or else you can't come back to China.
Oh my gosh.
And like she had family still in Xinjiang, so obviously she's not trying to get banned from the country.
Yeah.
So basically she goes back after she's called by the government. As soon as she gets there, she's like arrested and put in the camp, essentially.
Oh my goodness.
As soon as she come back, so they basically lured her back into the country and just sent her straight to the camp.
That's messed up.
And then she goes on to sort of talk about the conditions of the camp and sort of what she went through.
Mm-hmm.
And it's just insane. Like, apparently they had 11 or 12 hours a day of just learning like Chinese propaganda, sort of nationalistic education plan. Like, they were reciting the national anthem, you know, their
the education aspect of the camp.
Yeah, like the 12 hours a day.
Jeez.
That is insane. And apparently she said something about how they were put in these little like essentially prison cells. And it was like two or three women in a cell.
Yeah.
And then they would have no toilet. They just have a bucket.
Oh my gosh.
And they'd have no like toilet paper, any like hygienic, anything for their hygiene. You know what I'm saying? Like,
that's horrible.
That's worse than like an American prison, just fundamentally. You know what I'm saying?
Yeah.
And none of these people actually did anything wrong.
Exactly. And they're not being tried. It's not even like they're being put on trial for any crime or anything. They're just being detained without reason.
Exactly. Like, for instance, if you put up halal, like the halal food sign in your restaurant in Xinjiang, you'll get arrested.
Oh my god. Wow.
Like, you'll straight up get arrested. Like, she was saying how certain people, if you're walking outside at the wrong time, you'll get arrested. Like, that's, you know, they'll be like, oh, where are you going? Like, if they hear you talk, if they hear them talking in their actual language, they'll get arrested. Wow. And people need to understand that, like, Xinjiang, or at least part of it, is essentially, should be an autonomous region. It should be, I think it's East Kurdistan. That's the Uyghurs call themselves. Yeah, they have their own flag. Ooh. They have their own language, culture. So essentially, China just annexed like a whole country.
I see.
Or like a whole region. And now they're trying to force everyone to be exactly like them. Like, it's crazy. It's really crazy.
Kind of similar to how they are trying to control Hong Kong. Despite the
It's like that, but it's worse. You know what I'm saying? Like, it's definitely crazy.
And I also heard something about how they're actively publicizing the fact that they're sterilizing Uyghur women, and they're marking it as saying that, like, they're introducing birth control measures and sexual education so that they can no longer be baby making machines or something. But it's just like, from what you've said and from what other accounts I've read of things that happen in the camp, that they permanently sterilize them and prevent them from having kids as like a means to control the population. And they're just covering it up and marketing it as something that's like for women's rights, you know, which is really just messed up.
No, it's so messed up. And the way that the Chinese government is able to sort of justify what they're doing.
Yeah.
Is essentially they're just calling all the Uyghurs terrorists, like Islamist extremists.
Mm-hmm.
That's sort of their justification. That's why, like, the woman was saying in, I'm pretty sure it was a video, the woman was saying in the video how during re-education, the teachers would like hit them and call them terrorists, like the first couple of days, anytime they spoke their own language.
Mm.
And that just hurts my heart, you know, like,
it's actually quite similar to how residential schools were for indigenous
people.
And it's like how Guantanamo Bay is for suspected Islamist terrorists coming to the U.S.
It's just this world, man. Sometimes I just gotta question the world. Like one more little news piece on this sort of Xinjiang problem is so there was a group of like a Uyghur sort of activist group, mm-hmm. and essentially they're planning on trying to boycott the 2022 Olympic Games in China. They're trying to basically boycott the sponsors.
Oh.
So one of the members, I'm pretty sure, is either part of Airbnb or has some connection.
Uh-huh.
And Airbnb is actually a sponsor for the Olympic Games in 2022. So this sort of coalition of people is from different countries. I think it's Japan, Norway, Canada, I think Australia, just a lot, like 10 different countries.
Yeah.
And they're trying to get the sponsors to like remove their sponsorship, essentially.
Oh, okay.
Because
until China does something about what they're doing to the Uyghurs.
Sorry, say that again?
Is that like a measure that they're trying to do to make China pay attention and like do something and take accountability for what they're doing?
Yeah, exactly. Like it's essentially kind of like sanctioning China because China's such a power. There's honestly, outside of the US and Russia, no one could do anything. And even if the US and Russia did anything, that would just start like a global catastrophe.
Yeah. So do you think the sanctions will actually work?
Like, honestly,
the boycott aspect?
I don't.
I think it has to be a lot more widely absorbed and widely adhered to if it's going to work. Because, I mean, a few hundred people boycotting the Olympics won't do anything.
Exactly. And I think with sort of COVID and everything going on, like, this whole Uyghur issue is just going to get completely swept under the rug until, like, 5 years from now, where everyone's going to be like, oh, you know, like, how do we not do anything? Just because there's so much stuff happening in the world, and especially when you're dealing with superpower like China, it's just, what do you really do? You know, all you can really do is set sanctions and sort of, like, tariffs and stuff.
The most that individuals can do, I think, is just to raise awareness of these things. Because the first step to changing anything is making sure that people know about it, you know?
Exactly. So I want to say to anyone listening right now, if you're actually interested in this topic, please, please just do your own bit of research, talk to your friends about it, because it's a huge, huge thing that's happening, and it's just super underreported for many different reasons. And I think that it's our job as hosts at this radio station to try and sort of push this. I know, who knows what's going to happen, but I feel like that's our moral duty, to be honest with you.
Yeah. And I think I've definitely seen more information about what's happening with the Uyghurs in China. I've seen more of this on social media as opposed to like mainstream media outlets. And even the ones on mainstream media outlets that I've seen are not very, it's like been a handful of mainstream media outlets, and they don't go into very much depth about the stories. Like, they just, they give a brief overview and that's it. The most of the details I've gotten are from things that are posted on social media, or like by smaller independent papers.
Yeah, I definitely agree. Yeah, it's like there is some reporting by places like The Guardian and the BBC on the Uyghurs.
Yeah.
Like Vice News, but even then it's never like a big headline, just because.
Yeah, it's like secondary to everything else that's happening. You know, not as a front page or like a headliner.
Yeah, it's just, I just can't even think of a solution at this point, other than for Uyghurs to just try as hard as they can to like get out of China. There definitely has to be, like, even then, like, as I said, the woman left China for 10 years.
Yeah, and I feel like you shouldn't really tell people to get out, even if it's for their own protection. It's not going to be easy for them to leave behind their country and their culture and everything that they know. So that's not even really a proper solution, you know, because then they'll just be displaced.
Yeah, exactly. Like, IDPs at this point, like internally displaced people, because just like the littlest slip up and they're going to like essentially a concentration camp.
Yeah.
For 2 years, you know what I'm saying? Like,
yeah.
No, I'm definitely going to think about how this could be solved, because it's just such a tragic thing, you know what I'm saying?
Yeah, and I think the moral of the story is that we should all be doing our own research onto these things and just being individually more aware, because clearly we can't rely on just the media alone to make us aware of these things.
Exactly, I completely agree. And just to touch on the point about the Beijing Winter Olympics sponsors, so they're actually targeting the chief executive officer of Airbnb, Brian Chesky. And they're trying to get him to take away. He secured a 500 million English pound sponsorship.
Wow.
Yeah, that kind of seems to me like a low amount for the Winter Olympics and for like such a big thing like Airbnb. But regardless, that doesn't really matter. And the coalition, they're also referring to the Winter Olympics as the Genocide Games.
Wow.
I think that's very powerful, and I think that should be like hashtag genocide game. When it comes to that point, I think we should like try something on that with social media.
Talk about sensational marketing.
Yeah, exactly. But yeah, it's just quite crazy. But any more topics you want to hit on? I think we're getting close to time.
Yeah, I think we should just end it here. Just to add on though, I read that Ontario government plans to have everyone vaccinated by the summer. So do you think that's going to work out?
No, there's no way. Honestly, there's no way. But I mean, shout out to them for being optimistic.
Yeah. But
I think logistically, there's no way. Like, look at where we are at this point, and we're still not, I don't even know how many people have been vaccinated, but I know for a fact, I don't know anyone that's been vaccinated. My parents, you know what I'm saying? Like, there's still, I think
we'll get a good amount of people vaccinated by summer.
But yeah,
I don't think it will be enough to have everything reopen in September. You know, like, I'm pretty sure our September semester will still be online and everything.
Yeah.
We won't even know how well the vaccine will perform, like, in mass conditions, you know?
Yeah, honestly, I don't even want to think about that at this point. Hopefully things will be less longer, but I do agree it will be a stretch, but you never know.
Yeah.
But I think that's all we have for you guys today. Thank you so much for tuning in to Radio Laurier News at Noon. My name is Jeffrey.
And I'm Rajni, and we'll see you next week. Thank you.
Take care, guys.